Gracias.
Gracias.
Too many projects. Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. My name is Scott Nagle. I'm chair of the Juvenile Subcommittee of the Arizona Sex Offender Advancement Board. Still getting used to rituals. Do I need to make a motion to start the meeting too? Or?
No, just call the meeting to order, date, time.
Calling the meeting to order, I am. I pass it back to you, Jenna, for roll call.
All right, so Chairman Nagle is here. Mr. Barney, participating virtually.
Yes, present.
Mr. Galarno?
Present.
Dr. Maury?
Present.
Ms. Oppheim?
Present.
And Judge Young, participating virtually.
Present.
Hello,
I'm
out
here.
There.
Hello.
Hello, thank you. Have a quorum.
Okay. I think without further ado, I'm going to pass the baton to the folks at ECS and let them roll with what they come to share with us. Can I get all of you to remind me names so that we know who we're talking to?
Yeah, are we good over here? Do we need to sit in the hot seat anymore?
Wherever you're comfortable.
Yeah,
yep.
It works.
Stand or sit.
You guys. My name is Nick Pulaski. I'm actually a member of the board, main board. So that's myself. Thanks for having us here today.
Thank you.
And then my colleagues are here with me. That'll be most of the actual things. So I'll let them do this themselves.
Super.
Good afternoon. My name is Lani Sol. I'm a DCS supervisor with placement administration.
Nice to meet you.
My name is Dan. I'm a placement coordinator for placement administration.
And then do we have somebody online as well?
Yes.
Yes, you certainly do. Hi, my name is Amelia Kerlock. I am the System of Care Administrator with DCS-CHP.
So a question to you folks from DCS. How would you like us to roll if we have questions about things that we hear you say? Do you want us to chime in as we roll along? Do you want us to hold questions and let you talk about some things? I'm certainly open, whatever works best for you. Super.
I don't necessarily have a preference. Yeah.
Okay. Good. I think that probably makes the most sense, but I didn't want to be authoritarian.
Yes.
All right. Well, I pass it to y'all.
Wonderful. So again, thank you for having us. My name is Marisol. I am one of the DCS Placement Administration Supervisors at the Department of Child Safety. And then you can. So in the sense of what we do in placement administration, there's two units. We're the emergency unit, where we seek for homes for any children who need a home within less than 7 days. Kids who are in a hospital, there's no time frame of a discharge date. We kind of communicate with them alongside. And of course, any children who are being released from detention. Then there is a non-emergency placement unit. That's where he works with. Those are any placements needed from 8 to 30 days. Any placement disruptions in general from any type of placement, foster home, high need foster care, a higher level of care, or any type of group homes. And as well as any juvenile correction release. So Daniel and I are actually Adobe liaisons. We've been Adobe liaisons for quite some time. So those are the kids we work alongside with. So one of the DCS hierarchies that we focus on is always finding family-like setting placements, which is kinship. We also ask individuals who are with family, you know what, I'm so sorry, that came a little weird. So when we ask case managers if kinship has been explored when a child comes into DCS care, we also remind them or ask if there's any family-like settings or someone a child has a relationship with that may not be kinship, but we call them fictive kinships. That's one of the things that we always ask first before we can even think about any other type of. From there, we find we like a child to be placed in a family-like setting, which is a licensed foster home, through DCS. If a child has behavioral health services, we ask for a therapeutic foster home referral, which again is a family life setting. When all those have been rolled out and we have no opportunity to take those children in a family life setting, we seek residential group homes, QRTP residential, I apologize, QRTP is a qualified residential treatment program that we utilize for those kids. And of course, a shelter, which is meant to be a short-term temporary placement for them when we're waiting for something, when a higher level of care is needed, or there's locations which we're going to do a lateral within another agency.
Scott Nagley, can I ask a quick question? The residential group home level and the qualified residential treatment program, are those DCS licensed programs or are those OBHL licensed programs?
So the only one that is not DCS will be the therapeutic foster home, and that's their behavioral health. It licensed foster home, residential group home, and QRTP, as well as shelter, those are through DCS. So in order for us to determine in what type of placement a child should be headed to, it's, and I apologize, I keep saying this a little backwards. When DCS becomes involved with any family and the child is not able to stay within the family with a family right setting, that's when we get trained in as in placement administration. And that's going to be when either the child cannot stay home in a safely sense, or the child cannot stay with any family members. And at that moment, the specialist or OCWI investigator are going to submit a service request. And the service request is going to allow placement administration to gather all the information, to gather as much information to know what type of placement we're going to be seeking for that child. Again, we're going to ask one more time, has all family life settings, all kinship been rolled out? A lot of individuals do get tired of us because we want to know if there's any kinship. A lot of the times children are connected with teachers, so we'll ask if there's anybody in school, if there's anybody anywhere else that, you know, could be assessed and considered to be placement. So the information that we gather that we need, it's in order to find the most appropriate placement for the child. I apologize. This is going to allow us to find, again, the least restrictive placement. And the information that we consider and find most important is, of course, the child's probation information, if the child is to be on probation, those attention release orders, requirements, and then, of course, any recommendations for a higher level of care. If a child has been already detained, if a child is currently in correction, a lot of the times we already have information ahead because probation officer has been communicating with DCS, because we already have some understanding and idea of, you know, if they're there due to specific charges.
Scott Nagley, another question, if I may. In terms of the number of kids who present with the issues that we're all here to talk about, what percentage of them are either on probation or have made their way to ADJC versus those that are just wards, if I'm making sense, but the kids that have these issues. Do you have a sense of those numbers?
I don't have those numbers on hand. So you'd be talking about like some that are adjudicated just for supporting
that. Yeah, some that are adjudicated for these issues, and then some that have gone through the probation system and found their way to ADJC, and then those that present with the same issues but are not adjudicated. Like, I guess I'm just trying to get my arms and brain around, you know, numbers and proportion of numbers.
I think that would be, it's going to be a little bit difficult just because the placement administration, I think we're the last ones to get informed, but the child is going to be leaving a home. But a child, we need to step in and find the most appropriate home for a child. I think those will be more higher ups.
Those numbers that exist, does somebody have that data?
Nicholas.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I can look and see if I can box the tape answer. See if we can pull that data.
I don't know where Scott's going with this, but I guess I kind of have somewhat similar question. I run, I mean, for those who don't know, I run residential homes. And so not on your list was a VHRF that is licensed by ADHS, but we do have a contract with DCS. So not all of them are licensed by DCS, but we do take kids in our homes, not very frequently, but then I have an outpatient program. And so we deal with a lot of the QRTPs with our outpatient therapists. And what we find is that, you don't want to throw up numbers either without knowing, but a legitimate large amount of the kids in the DCS QRTPs for sexually maladaptive behaviors are not on probation. So I guess one of my big questions, and I'm not sure it can be answered here, but I've always kind of wondered what happens, how do those kids get there? If a DCS hotline is called and somebody says, my son has been, you know, inappropriately touching, abusing, assaulting my three other siblings. I just feel like sometimes it makes it to the court, sometimes it makes it to PD, sometimes there's a call for police, and then sometimes it doesn't. So I feel like our houses, at least my experience with the group homes, is we have a lot of kids not on probation and some kids that are. Some kids go to treatment, some kids don't. Some have the justice system involved, some don't. So I don't know how that kind of breaks down up at the top. And I get it. Sometimes you guys are the last to know. But I don't know where it breaks down, like why police are called sometimes, why they're not. And I get it if a county attorney or probation decides not to charge a kid and they were there and then they left, and they're still with you guys. But it feels like a lot of kids have never even seen a judge or the inside of the courtroom. You know,
so in the criteria of QRTP, we utilize, and actually to any non-QRTP or QRTP scenario, we do utilize the three things. And then Ms. Jenna goes to the next slide. We look at the child's, of course, background behavior, any pending charges, or any behavioral health services that can fall into that. There are many occasions in which we get those hotline calls, we read those hotline calls, we see some concerning behaviors, there is something, but we kind of hit a wall. You know, people who have been in the same field for an extended period of time can pick up those little hints. I'm pretty sure you guys see them. And
while he was finishing up his degree.
And I think sometimes too, what we'll see is like a call will come to our hotline, our hotline will call in for admission. Sometimes it doesn't reach
the hooking with you, and I will plan at least to
child safety is going to investigate, you know, things that are allegations that are happening in the home, and if something happened outside the home, like if he was at school, he or she was at school, and you know, there's some allegations made there, the different entities other than Department of Child Safety. But I think we get involved with children that are approaching the threshold, but yet don't quite cross that threshold. And that's information that we'll get when we're gathering,
yeah,
whether or not.
I wanted to be mindful of that, too. I'm sure you're getting spaces, too, so I don't want to jump the gun.
No. And like Daniel said, we receive the information, and our job as placement and administration is to gather everything. And we're the ones that at times we pick up on those little things. Then we let the case manager, the investigator, the OCW investigator, know of additional information, and as we work together.
Joe Kilroy has his hand up and has a question.
Hi, this is Joe Kilroy, and Scott, to your question on the number, we've been involved with DCS for a decade on the crossover youth practice model. So we have numbers who are duly adjudicated in both delinquency and dependency, but we don't have numbers just specific to Mel's question on how many kids have this behavior that may receive treatment or not. But are not part of the court system. So there is data. We have reports on that duly adjudicated juvenile.
So half of the equation, I guess, or a third, perhaps.
I have no idea what, you know, how many kids we're talking about in child welfare that are strictly child welfare. But I do know the number of kids that have crossed into both dependency and delinquency. And I did have one question for the speakers. Could they explain what differences between a QRTP and a group home residential or residential group home from one of those earlier slides?
think I'm going to answer this extremely bad. So QRTP is a common residential treatment plan that is federally funded. So it is supposed to be a short-term plan, a short-term placement to allow the support to children to meet their behavioral goal. In the sense of SMB placements, they have the same exact goal. That's the only difference with having a QRTP placement, child placed in a significant trauma home and a structure approval home as a standard residential home. With SMB, I do believe, and based on my past experience, it doesn't matter if you're QRTP or non-QRTP, the goal is the same, is to help the child, to support the child, to meet their criteria, regardless on information, parole, any other charges, to be on treatment and attend treatment. So that is the one difference. But QRTP is supposed to be a short-term placement goal to allow the children to reach that behavioral stabilization to step down to a family-like setting. As in an SMB, QRTP, non-QRTP, the goal is the same, to allow the children to return to the family-like setting in an into a home that there's no victims.
But perhaps the timelines are different between those
yeah.
two. So, sure. And I don't want to get ahead of myself because maybe you're going to talk about it, but I'd be really interested to know how you're deciding which kids go to which of those places. And once that's decided by whatever that process looks like and criteria looks like, how do we decide what's being used to decide that they should move from that, whether that be to a lower level care or a high level care? I'd be genuinely interested in that part of the discussion.
Yeah, so next we'll talk about kind of like the cohort and like pretty much how they're going to end up in the homes that are going to require sexually maladaptive behaviors, SMB cohorts. And these, we're going to look at, the release orders, if they've been adjudicated, what are the conditions that they need to be at. And then if they haven't reached that threshold, we're going to see like the history of the child and see what the allegation was. Was there anything that came from it? Should we be looking at a pattern, or to make sure that we're not, again, putting that any other children at risk? So if we have some allegations or multiple allegations of the youth possibly perpetrating on younger youth, then we want to make sure that we're getting them in a home that's licensed for only 12 and on up, so that we're not putting any other younger victims or possible victims or other youth at risk. And then if they've been referred to any kind of treatment, then we will also get them into an SMB cohort home. Again, that could be a SMB QRTP or SMB residential. One of the other differences between a QRTP and a residential home is your QRTPs are going to employ staff that have gone through additional training and that are kind of trained to work with children that are more trauma-informed care to provide for those kids. And so it's going to be a bit of a higher degree of structure and a higher degree of supervision in your residential homes. So that's another difference between the residential and the QRTP home. Again, as far as like time, get back to your question about timeline. The team, not so much placement administration, but the youth's team, the whole team, they're going to be looking at and having their meetings and kind of coming together to see what the progress is. And that's when the therapists and stuff will also be part of those child and family team meetings, talk about the progress, where they are in their treatment. And then, it's pretty much a live evaluation of, is it safe to be in a different setting if needed. So that's also determined whether or not.
And when you say the team, you mean the team that's in place around that child at that time, both from your side of the equation, but also from the treatment side and wherever the kid should be residing, whether that's in a foster home or whether that's.
Correct. Later on, one of our colleagues is going to be presenting on that child family team, and that's going to include the DCS worker, the staff from the group home where they're currently at, the behavioral health sites, all the therapists and whoever else is involved, whatever other services are involved, someone from a representative from that should be attending these meetings as well to provide an update of the progress.
So Scott Nagley again, beyond the dialogue and the discussion that's going on where everybody's offering their input as to what they know about this child and the family and what are the presenting issues, beyond that kind of stuff going on, what kind of a structured process do we have in terms of using risk assessment scales or protective and risk scales to evaluate whether or not we've got the kid in the right level of care? Is any of that stuff, anything like that happening?
I do believe that a lot of this falls into also the documentation and communication that we can have through that hearing. When DCS just doesn't put a note and then we choose or we flip the coin to where the child is going to go. We gather all the information to see what would be the most appropriate, the best setting environment for that child.
But it is that decision-making matrix, my word, is that something that has been driven by research or by empiricism in making those kinds of decisions? Am I making sense?
Yeah, I don't think I could answer that. I haven't been informed or aware of any. I kind of get what you're saying. It's kind of a risk analysis guideline matrix to go by.
Yeah, like, yeah. Exactly.
No, anyway, but I actually have quite a bit to say about this topic, but I'll let you guys go through your slides, and then I just can give some of my experiences that might answer some of yours or even just kind of what I've experienced on the other end, but I can feel like I'm stopping you, but I'll see if you guys, you want to go.
I apologize for that.
No, I just don't want to.
I know as we move along, if I don't articulate some of these in the moment, they're going to be lost, so.
Yeah. And again, mainly our experiences when we're trying to initially find that placement for them, or if they're disrupting from a current placement, you know, we're going to get involved at that time. Once they are placed, then it's, you know, the child's team that's really working on it. They provide us any information, any updates once, again, we're asked to look for another placement or what have you. That's when we get involved again. All right, next slide. And then when we go and we do figure out where we're going to put them, and if we are putting them in an SD home, another thing we're going to look at to kind of determine which of those SD homes we're going to put out, we're going to be looking at the location of the home, because we definitely want to keep everything normal that the youth was going through. So we try to keep them in the same school district, same school possibly. So they have a lot of their non-therapeutic support still around them that they've had. It's going to be the most successful for the youth and to progress with anything that they might be needing. And again, we always just try to get, we're going to push it, look for the family setting. I always continue to work with the families to try to make sure that we could try to develop a plan to get them back into either the same, into the family home or a victim kinship or some other kinship. And then this, we'll go ahead and pass it on to our colleague.
Thank you so much. Any questions before I hop into discussing how youth in DCS custody get behavioral health services? Excellent. Thank you for the opportunity to be able to speak today. So I wanted to provide just a little bit of a foundational understanding I'm going to try not to get too lost into the weeds about child and family team, because certainly that could be a very large training per se. But so I wanted to, again, just provide the indication. So children and youth in DCS custody receive behavioral health services through the CFT process. CFT stands for child and family team. So at the time of removal, when youth are coming into out-of-home care, an integrated rapid response assessment referral is submitted, and then they are subsequently assessed within the 72 hours of that referral being received by the provider to complete the assessment. And so this assessment of needs subsequently drives the service plan and referral process for identified services. It's really the process for how youth get enrolled into behavioral health services. And this process is guided by Arizona 12 principles, and certainly could go down a rabbit hole of all of those particular things. But it's really just, you know, good coordination with the team and with the family, and taking into account the child's needs and experiences, the family's cultural needs, that sort of thing. Also timely access to care, et cetera. And then child and family team members can be, as my colleagues were indicating previously, the child, the guardian is the DCS specialist, and anyone that the child identifies as a support to them, and also family and additional caregivers, and anyone that the family might select to be a participant. Next slide, please. This here is, I just wanted to sort of do a quick visual of what that CFT process looks like. So again, starts at the top with this overarching assessment, assessing for needs, and then again, subsequent referrals. So the assessment of needs at the CFT should also include identification of those strengths, needs, cultural discovery, some of what I had just previously indicated. From there, the team works collaboratively to build the service plan for the child. That is the little green box that you're seeing on the second level here, the ISP, Individualized Service Plan. Any service and identified need that the team is discussing should be listed on the youth service plan, primarily so that we can track trends and track where services are being referred to and the progress that the youth is making in those services. So the child and family team would meet on typically a monthly basis, could be more frequent if needed, depending on, again, the youth's needs, and discuss their status and progress in those services. Let's see, we'll get into a bit more of that third tier that you're seeing on there is really just indicating like these are the kinds of services that we can that you'll see coming from the service plan, which we'll talk about in the next few slides. So let's see, next slide, please. So this is what the structure looks like of the children's behavioral health system. So every child is assigned a behavioral health home at the time that they enroll into services. And as you can see in that purple shaded box, behavioral health homes can provide a variety of services. They would be responsible for the intake and that initial assessment, and then ongoing assessment of the youth's needs. They also provide the case management. There are also various tiers of case management, again, depending on the need of the child and their level of intensity that they might need. Behavioral health homes can typically also provide individual, group, and family therapy, psychiatric services, which can include medication monitoring if the youth needs medication, and then just ongoing coordination of care between all of the various service providers that could come into play. So as you'll see in that middle box, this is where we get more into the specific, like targeted services, I would say, for the population that we're talking about here, youth with sexual maladaptive behavior. So that's where you'll see service referrals being submitted out from the primary behavioral health home out to a specialty provider. Let me scroll through my notes to make sure I'm not missing anything. And then I don't think so. Then, so the third column that you'll see there is our residential levels of care, which I have, I think my next like three or four slides are all about that. So if there aren't any questions up until this point, we can progress. Oh, apologies. We'll get to the residential levels of care in a second. So, the different types of evaluations that can occur within the behavioral health network. There are three types of evaluations. The first two are listed here. The next one will be on the next slide. So we have psychosexual evaluation, which I am sure everyone here is familiar with. We also have listed the provider here that is within the network we utilize, Levitan and Associates. We also have a full comprehensive psychological evaluation, and we have three providers for those, Corazon, McGady, and then Levitan. And then on the next slide, there's also an option for a neuro developmental evaluation. So if there are some concerns about developmental delays, milestones, that sort of thing, a youth can engage in that type of evaluation. And then we've listed the providers here as well. Next slide. So these are, I understand that there was some question about providers within the network, who is out there and who is doing the treatment. So this here is, these are the specialty providers that I referred to in that like sort of beige colored column that was in the middle on the few previous slides. So we have six providers within the network who provide group, individual, and family therapy to address youth with sexually maladaptive behaviors. These behaviors can, or services can also potentially include intensive wraparound programming if that is something that would be beneficial to the youth. And you can see here on the slide the providers. So we have Arizona Center for Change, Grossman & Grossman, Mojave Mental Health, Resolution Group, U-Turn, shout out Mel, and then Casa de los Niños.
Really quick, Maya, is that just Maricopa County, or is that how, just I mean, I guess a lot of your slides specific just to our area, or I just wonder, are those kind of statewide or
over statewide.
Certain counties, or do you kind of have that information?
It is statewide, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's answer the whole state. Yes.
I'm so sorry. Repeat that one more time.
Just that those are the providers for this outpatient programs for that population for the whole state.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, specific to sexually maladaptive behaviors. Yes. Yep. And then the next slide is providers specific for youth with sexually reactive behaviors. So we have Encourage Empowerment, Grossman and Grossman, Casa de los Niños, and then the Resolution Group. And then next slide is where we'll get into the higher levels of care, so behavioral health levels of care that we were referring to before. So for youth who are displaying more intense behaviors than can be treated with outpatient services, the health plan offers residential levels of care to address those needs. So we have the Behavioral Health Inpatient Facility, BHIF. You may also have heard it called previously the RTC or Residential Treatment Center. The sort of mid-level is Behavioral Health Residential Facility, BHRF. Oftentimes those names get confused between which one is the highest level, which one is not, because of the word residential. I hear it often, it's confusing. And then we also have TFC, the Therapeutic Foster Care. And then let's see, it is important to note that the health plan does require prior authorization before admitting into those levels of care, because we need to confirm that youth are meeting the medical necessity criteria for admission for those settings. And then in the next few slides, we'll dive in just a little bit more into each of those levels of care. Perfect. So TFC is sort of the lowest level, I'll do air quotes around level, of residential services offered. And I say that because it's not necessarily a youth must do a TFC and have exhausted that before going to the next level of care, right? Like, they don't need to work through each of the levels up or down in either direction. So just wanted to provide that indication. But a TFC, as had previously been referenced, they're family settings where youth are residing with caregivers who have received specialized training to meet their needs. There's also a component that's important to remember for matching for this. We're not placing youth into settings where caregivers are not equipped and haven't received the appropriate training to be able to meet their needs. So there's really an interview process and opportunity for the family to decide to meet the youth, maybe not even meet the youth, but sometimes interviews do occur, but to really weigh out whether or not they are a good match for treatment for the youth and vice versa. Youth in TFC receive all of their services on a community basis, so they continue to maintain services with their behavioral health home for psychiatric monitoring, outpatient therapy, that sort of thing.
A question, if I may.
Sure.
Scott Nagy here. My question is this: when you're seeking to find a therapeutic foster home for a child with one of these types of issues, can you tell the board, the subcommittee, what access, to what degree do the potential foster parents have access to the client's file and all of the information in the client's file, and does that include whatever psychosexual evaluation that was done?
I think that it should, as long as the department has been, I think typically we get a court order for that to be released to us, especially if it hasn't been, if it's not a psychosexual evaluation that was completed within the behavioral health system, because we do from time to time see evaluations that are completed through like the probation referral process. And so in those situations, we need to ensure that it has been court ordered released to DCS for treatment purposes. And then once that happens, then yes, it should go into the youth's file and be a part of the supporting documentation when completing those referrals and that sort of thing. Did that answer the question?
I think so. I have other questions about the psychosexual, we can come back to that.
Okay. I think the next slide is touching on behavioral health residential facility. If you can switch to the next one, thank you. So this is the second highest level of care. In the behavioral health residential facility, youth will receive group and individual therapy within the treatment milieu within the BHRF setting. Depending on the provider agency, youth may also attend school in the community. If it's a facility such as YDI, there may be youth would be receiving school services or go to school on site. It sort of just depends on the setting, and also may receive psychiatric services in that particular setting. But for the most part, BHRF settings, youth are attending school in the community and or in whatever, you know, school setting the BHRF is arranging. And let's see, one of the things it's important to keep in mind, so there is set medical necessity criteria that the health plans are looking for when making determinations for each of these levels of care. And so one of the pieces of criteria for BHRF is youth must demonstrate significant risk of harm to self or others. We're specifically looking at the last 90 days of the time that prior auth or referral is being received by the health plan. So what have those significant and severe behaviors looked like during that period of time? And then because we're also indicating that youth who are being placed into BHRF for treatment need 24-hour supervision by an on-site BHT, behavioral health tech. But also not so severe behaviors that they need the highest level of care, which would require monitoring by a psychiatrist or a nurse practitioner, which we'll actually hear about on the next slide if you transition. So BHIF is the highest level of care, just down from an acute care setting, right? So not necessarily a hospital setting, but behavioral health inpatient youth who admit to these settings are displaying behaviors that do require 24-hour supervision to manage their psychiatric disturbance that's playing out for them, that's causing significant risk of harm to themselves or others. These youth do require 24-hour access to a psychiatrist or nurse practitioner to help manage their behavioral health symptoms that are putting themselves or others at risk. And this setting is like all-encompassing. Youth are going to school there. They're, again, seeing the psychiatrist or nurse practitioner. They're receiving all of their therapeutic services within that milieu as they're working on their targeted treatment goals. And then this last slide, nope, that was perfect. You can transition to the next one. Thank you. So just a few sort of reminders or nuances. So just wanted to indicate, so when exploring these out-of-home treatment settings as possible interventions to address youth needs, we do take into account their treatment history and their response to those previous interventions when reviewing those packets for these higher levels of care. So approval for higher level of care will not be given as an alternative to incarceration or to address or prevent runaway behaviors. That's even though the BHIFs do have the ability to have locked doors, or some of them may have tall fences around them, elopement can still occur and does still occur from those settings. Admission to these levels of care are not emergent, so it's important to keep that in mind. Youth may be in the community while waiting for these treatment settings to be identified, and so there may be a need for the team to plan alternative services and increase those outpatient services while waiting for youth to admit to these settings, because it can take a little bit of time while planning for that. And I think that might be my last. Oh no, the last slide is, if you want to go to the next one, this is the providers for BHIF and BHRF. So BHIF, we have Casa Grande Academy and YDI, and then BHRF, we have Back to Life, Progressive Health Alliance, U-Turn Foundation, and YDI also has a BHRF setting. That is it for me, but I know that there might be some, I know that there's questions, and I hope that I can answer the psychosexual questions that are going to pop up.
Scott Nagley here. I guess I'd be interested in what the psychosexual evaluations have within them as far as the protocol that's being used. I mean, literally, what do they consist of? What's in them? In terms of the different kinds of measures and psychometric testing.
Ooh, that is a wonderful pop quiz that I don't know that I feel confident to be able to just rattle that off the top of my head, unfortunately. I'm just going to take a look. Judge, yeah, go right ahead.
If you want, I can grab one and I can list all the tests that they do, because it's a pretty standard battery of tests that they do. I just had one this morning.
Yeah, that's what I was going to do, see if I could wrangle one on my mind.
I'm sorry.
Like an emergency care.
And this would have been done by somebody that's doing the screenings for DCS?
Yeah.
Okay. That'd be great.
I'll grab it. I'll be right back.
Thanks, Jen.
Somebody has to be here.
Oh, I know. I'm just saying it's not typically that you go through the CHP or the emergency care and the behavioral health steps. You know what I mean? It's a matter of who's requesting it. So DCS isn't always the request.
Not a question for the DCS folks. Did I hear correctly that you have a list of providers that are doing psychosexual evaluation? Did I hear that right?
Yeah. No, yes. But I'm requesting the documentation even as we have to send out the RMI in order to be able to. So there's placement administration maybe a little bit way lower on answering that question. I'm glad.
I guess a piece of this is coming back to me when I'm trying to get my head around the scope of the problem in terms of numbers and where kids are ultimately landing and who then is charged with driving the process from assessment to determining placement to the kinds of treatment that kids are getting. That's where my head is coming back to. I mean, I don't know how large or small the scope of the problem is as it relates to DCS only kids who have these issues. But more to follow, I guess. That's okay. Judge Young?
Sure. Yeah, so there's a clinical interview, then there are collateral interviews, which include family members, and then they do the Kaufman Brief Intelligence Test, second edition. Then they do the wide range test of achievement, that RAT, to determine reading level. Then there's the Millen Adolescent Clinical Inventory, second edition, that's the MACI 2. Then the Abel, Becker, and Kaplan Adolescent Cognition Scale. They do the ASIC, which is the Adolescent Sexual Interest Card Sort, the FASE Sexual Attitudes Questionnaire. Don't always see it, but this one has the PTSD checklist, the civilian version, trauma symptom checklist for children, the TSCC, the ABLE assessment of sexual interest, and then the JSOAP, the Juvenile Sex Offender Assessment Protocol, second edition. And those are the standard battery of tests and protocols that I see in all the psychosexuals I get, both on the dependency side and on the delinquency side.
I'm fairly confident I could tell you who your evaluator was because they consulted me previously about the protocol, but you don't have to comment. I think that that's pretty comprehensive. I will say, for the record, more comprehensive than I anticipated, especially given that there is an ABLE assessment in there.
Yeah, and there are a couple different providers that I see the reports from, depending on which system the kids are involved in, and it's pretty standard, those tests.
Glaringly absent, though, is polygraph testing, but that's a whole other discussion.
Blake has his hand up.
Blake?
Blake Barney. I guess one of the things that I'm thinking about through this whole process is how often does DCS review their approved providers, and what is the protocol for them to become or to maintain approved providers? Status with DCS, because sometimes there's certain things that change. So I don't know if it's similar to a probation contract where it's 4 years, and then after 4 years they do everything else, or they do the contract submission again. So I'm just curious that process.
That is another tough hitter. So Mercy Care provides the provider network for DCSCHP, and they are who directly contract with the providers. I would need to check. I don't know off the top of my head what that contract period looks like. I'm sorry, I can't answer that.
No, I could answer. We have an audit every year, but every 5 years is our contract. So people are showing up and checking us out often from DCS. But the biggest thing to remember is that DCS pays us for the kids to live there. DCS licenses my DCS home, but they're not the ones providing the treatment. So a lot of times when they're talking about CHIP and Mercy Care, it's like another entity is kind of paying the outpatient provider to see the therapy. So therapy and residential and room and board are two separate things. So a lot of times they get mixed up. And that's why I'm saying DCS doesn't offer request psychosexuals. It's usually the Mercy Care, the JFCS. There's a different provider, an access provider, requesting it.
At the request of DCS.
It could be the DCS is involved, but I'm not sure DCS pays for those, or they never seem like they're owned only by DCS. Like probation owns their psychosexuals, they pay for them. But we don't typically get DCS saying, oh, here, we ordered a psychosexual, unless it goes through one of their behavioral health homes.
So
it kind of gets not convoluted, but some of those, I mean, maybe Joe would know the answer, but I could have swore, is it McGrady? He's on an AOC contract as well for psychosexual. So some of those overlap.
Yes.
So one of the things I'm hearing perhaps as a challenge is securing the authority or the release of information to be able to move those to the people who need them to be able to do their work. Sounds like that's a challenge. Is that a fair statement to make?
No.
We're able to share that information because
stuff. Are you talking more about the placement initially?
Yes.
Well, we're usually going
about past these guys, like they've already had the psychosexuals by the time they're deciding where to place them. I can bring up a different topic though that I think maybe you're addressing, and it just looks like there's an evaluation involved. And I've been excited to have DCS here. Marisol and I go way back, and I've met Nicholas and I am at a board meeting now, and Amelia, I know we've had correspondence before, but I have two or three things I'd like to address, and I'm going to say it as easy or hopefully as simply stated as I can. But I do have some, not necessarily concerns, but some questions as to placements. For example, I'm glad you went over the CFT process. I brought my Access CFT packet. It's 18 pages. I know well what the CFT is supposed to and why. I mean, I know the creator of it from years back at Access. I know why it was created, and it was a lot to have a team decision process. I don't want to make this personal, but it's very personal. If anybody has talked to me, I didn't lose my voice for this, but I often lose my voice for this. It's very personal to me because we are trying to help kiddos. I was asked and approached by the DCS director years ago to open a QRTP. My response was, I will, because I have nowhere for my BHRF kids that get abandoned to go. So I would love to have a continuum of care with my treatment, my schools, my jobs, my churches, all the stuff that our kids get used to being in our BHRF, move them to a DCS QRTP. That didn't last very long. I didn't really agree with some of the stuff that was happening with the QRTPs. I think the biggest thing was nobody asked me anything about sexual maladaptive behaviors when I got licensed. And I thought that was kind of odd. So I said, you know what? Let me just do the standard DCS SMB group. I always was transparent about wanting some of my own kids to continue in my own care. And not that I'm not taking other DCS kids, but why wouldn't I take the kids we're already involved with? I have probably lost over the last five, I don't know how long you guys been doing QRTPs, 5-6 years now, probably 30 kids where I've been stopped by placement taking a kid, either from my own care or from a YDI treatment perspective. So just this week, 3 days ago, there's been a team, CFT team, family, DCS, three other people involved with mentors and all the stuff that goes around wrapping around a kid, including, of course, the DCS YDI team, slotted to come to asked and wanted the aftercare that comes with the freeway DCS SMB house. And the DCS person called me and said, okay, let's get you this kiddo. The court's ready to order it, but they haven't yet, but everybody's on board. It sounds like it's a great fit. I said, great, we actually have a bed. Let's get him in. And then it was just shut down. It was, nope, he's got to go to a QRTP. So I'm very interested in how that happens, how, and I'm not blaming placement, but there's some people or an entity out there that suddenly gets a kid's name. They've never met the child. Sometimes they do the Cal Locus that didn't come up, and maybe it's not being used anymore. But a Cal Locus after 2 years of being at YDI is not going to be the same as somebody who knows the kid and has been watching the progress of the kid. So suddenly there's a Cal Locus that says, nope, they need a QRTP. And I'm pretty sure I heard you say that really, or maybe it was Marisol that said, they really are kind of the same level of care. It's kind of apples and oranges, and depending on who you ask, it depends. Like the QRTPs that my outpatient therapists are dealing with, half those kids aren't getting therapy. The staff aren't aware of what to do with a kid with SMB issues. There's a lot of training lacking, at least from our experience with the kids that we're dealing with. But again, 5 out of 10 kids are getting therapy at the QRTPs. Another 5 aren't supposed to or don't have to. They're given the option. So my house is not an option. I have a lesser group home, if you will. It's not a QRTP. But I don't know how this happens. I don't know how placement really does happen. And it used to be like, oh, well, there's 5 people at the placement team and they decide and don't ask any questions and there's a Cal Locus involved. But I feel bad for the teams. I've got therapists calling me upset. I've got families calling me crying because they thought they were deciding. And then at the last minute, in a matter of hours, somebody else decides that that's not where they're going and they get to go to a different kind of group home. And it's frustrating. That's just kind of one of my issues. And as far as level of care, and I totally appreciate your slides, Amelia, and like this is what a BHRF looks like, and this is what a DCS SMB, and this is what a QRTP might look like. But I'm very concerned, and I have a big, huge question. It was typed, and then I reiterated it with my pen, that I don't know when kids get reassessed back to evaluation protocols. We have, and this is kind of a caveat, I know it's just my talking of my experience, and I thought my therapist was going to come today, not that she could talk, but she is very upset because there are 3 kids in a group home plotting a rape against a staff. When I found out who these 3 kids were, one of them we said, absolutely not. We're not going to see him outpatient. He probably belongs in a BHIF. And we recommended that a year and a half ago. He's still there at a QRTP with no treatment. The other kid, we had him in outpatient. We discharged him because he had very, very high risks at school and in the home trying to act out. Now these kids are trying to approach a staff and have continued to write out their plot and their planning. When we discharged him, we thought something would happen and that kid would have to go to at least another provider, if not a higher level of care. And he's still there. It's been 6 months. So I think I don't know how your system works with that, but it's like he doesn't get back to you guys that, hey, I mean, the group home is like, well, we're still getting paid. We just don't have to take the kid to a therapist every week. You know, it's one less ride we have to give them. So I'm worried that the care for some of the QRTPs in particular that we work with, and there's 3, maybe 4 of them, is that the feedback doesn't get, you know, when we have a PFDA, when we have probation, we have them to go back to and say, hey, kid is acting out. We don't want him at our group home anymore. He's not amenable to our treatment. He needs YDI. And I'm worried that DCS doesn't have a lot of that back and forth with the group home managers, so it may just fall on them, not telling you guys. But there are some very risky kids that are just living in these homes with no therapy and not a lot of reassessment, if you will. And then we're dealing with it because we have kids telling us they're scared to go home to their QRTPs, and then we're trying to move them to our home where we feel like he'll be safe, and then I get in trouble because we're trying to steal kids. So I have a couple of issues. Those are just the 2 I'm going to throw out there. But I do worry that the system is just seeing some of these kids and the treatment, whether they're not getting treatment at all. I've been told if a DCS kid comes to me, he doesn't have to go to treatment. And that's sad to me because that's why he's there. But we had a kid, I think if I said his name, all 4 of you would know it. He's had several offenses sexually and never been caught by the law, never been reported. Nobody's ever filed charges. And yet he continues to have predatory behavior. And I was told if he came to my house, he could choose to go to treatment and to talk about therapy or not. And that's just not how I operate. And I know I operate different because I've been on the behavioral health side. But I don't know, just kind of throwing it out there that these are a couple of the really big glitches when I have a CFT decide they want to come here, but then they can't. Nobody can explain how that gets solved somewhere upstream, you know, from a kid, from a standpoint of somebody who's never met the kid or doesn't know anybody in the team, you know?
So Scott Nagley, I think part of what I'm hearing is part of where some of my questions are coming from, and it's not accusatory. I'm wanting to understand what the structured way and what are we using as that structure, whatever that might be, to make the types of decisions that we're having articulated now. And I think from my perspective, we as a system, not just the DCS part of the system, but we collectively as a system, we need to get to the place where we are using what we have available to us with respect to research and science to help guide making these decisions. And then we need to ensure that we have people that are properly trained in the utilization and scoring of these instruments so that we have solid inter-rater reliability amongst the ranks, no matter where those are being done, so that we can be making decisions that aren't personal, that aren't subjective, that aren't bothersome, that are truly objective in orientation. I have ideas about that. We're just trying to gather as much information as we can collectively from the different parties that are doing a piece of this work with these kids and their families. While I have a long history of having worked with juveniles and juvenile families and running residential treatment program, I've been away from that arc for a spot of time. So for me personally, asking y'all to come was about trying to get up to speed again to see what's the same, what's different, how are we making decisions so that I, in a meaningful sort of way, can contribute to this subcommittee's work. I mean, that's really where I'm coming from. So when I ask, is this starting to get to know me a bit, I got to see the landscape. I got to see it all to be able to start making decisions about how we need to structure ourselves and how we need to get buy-in, perhaps at some point in time from the legislature to help us do what we're all trying to do. And I don't question anybody's integrity in terms of trying to do the right thing for kids. But I think that we end up getting in, may I say, pissing matches around things, that if we did things in a more systematic and structured way, we wouldn't have to get into those moments in time. At least not as much. There's going to be differences of opinion no matter what we do here. But the more we can have an overarching structure, no matter which system of care the kid belongs to, that we're doing things, you know, similarly, I just think that's where it's at. Do others have questions about anything the folks in DCS are trying to share with us? Or do you guys have things that you want us to know? I mean, I don't want to pretend that I got it, because I don't.
Well, just kind of address the QRCP thing. I work in a QRCP unit. So our structure is every 6 months, if a child is still remaining in the QRCP, we need to make a review and assessment to see if they are still needing that QRCP. One of the requirements to be in a QRTP is to be doing behavioral health services. So what we do is every so often, I forgot the exact timeline, providers are providing placement administration with reports, exhibit one reports that kind of break down everything, services that they're supposed to be attending or what they have. Sometimes they list the services that they refer to, but they're not really putting down what their engagement is. At that 6 months, when we're doing that assessment, if we feel like we just don't have enough information, or we need more information, or if we have information to say that, yes, you know, we've done a review and it still continues to be QRTP needed, then we do that at that point. If we do see that there's evidence that there is no services involved, or they're not engaged, or we find out behavioral health has been closed out, which they shouldn't be, then we request that CFT. We attend it ourselves, as like I said, as a placement coordinator, QRTP. I attend them, request what's going on, and if they still are refusing services, then we ask that they submit a placement referral so that we can get that child out of that QRTP and get them into another appropriate. Again, we'll also work with behavioral health if higher level care is needed, or we even assess that a higher level care may be needed. You know, we kind of make sure that we're able to see that and, you know, everyone. Let the case manager know, because, you know, they are guardian. We kind of guide them through to make those suggestions if needed, if they're not already making those suggestions. And again, we do have to remind our case managers that, you know, if the child is needing the services, they need to make sure that they're having those conversations with them, let them know that they need to be in these services. They can't just be at the home not doing those services. And sorry for anyone who's able to sign in the homes. But yes, that kind of answers some of that. Yeah, we do have our
support. Are you a contact for me then? Because I really don't have a lot of contacts, and I don't want to blow anybody up or bother anybody. But if somebody's just not getting treatment for 6 months and they're still in a home approaching our kid for, you know, sexual and misappropriate behaviors every day, can we reach out to you saying, hey, maybe it's the home not getting a hold of you. Maybe it's somebody or the case manager, or I don't know who to call when we see it. And it, I mean, I'm sure you guys have systems in place. But if they're not happening, I don't want to be a tattletale, but I also don't like kids, you know, taking the whole group home down with them.
Because they might have a little bit more, you know, a better connection. But yes.
With the high needs case manager, with more of those mental health.
No, the system of care coordinator is just within us. Yes. Yes. You're more than welcome to always reach out. I mean, if he gives you his number.
That's fine.
You
We even have a QRTB inbox through our email. So if you have a general question, you can go to the QRTB inbox, email that. We do.
And the hard part is when we discharge them because they're too risky, unfortunately, we just hear about them or we see them when we show up to the home still, but we don't have a lot of say because at that point we're done with the team.
Sometimes
we don't worry about that kid just not getting the
sometimes we'll come in involved with that because Behavioral Health has been submitting those referrals for higher level care. They keep getting denials, out-of-state denials, in-state denials. Comes down to the kid either right now, the public safety hazard. Then we have to kind of assess where the best place that we can set them and just try to take the information that we have and try to get them into
Scott Nagley, I can't help but believe that in some instances, because we haven't agreed upon the structure of how we articulate our concerns and our arguments about what Kid X needs, and haven't systematically done that in the same way across the board. You know what I'm saying?
The formal documentation that's specific to these issues
that hindering work to get those kids what they need.
Some of what we have to do is create this in a way that it's not easy for people to refuse to work with us and to take the kids. You know what I mean?
That's where I can get that word. Or they set the requirements for a higher level of care is exactly getting denials from in-state and out-of-state for those behaviors. And we're like, well.
And part of what I'm saying is we have at our disposal, if we choose collectively to use them, some risk scales that have been researched and a protective scale.
But we've now communicated, now we've created a language that we have to begin to communicate around the concerns that we're all sitting in this room, you know, talking about and trying to see responses to. We just have to figure out how to foster some acceptance of that. I was happy to hear that whoever the evaluator was used a JSO. Now, I will tell you not to make things more muddy and less. But the creator of the eraser, which is the analogous instrument to the JSO, he at this point in time himself isn't even using his own instrument anymore because he's created another instrument called a professor. Now, that so there's lots to talk about here. I know why Jim Willing, I know why he did that, and I know why he's moved that way. Now, I, on the other hand, continue to use the JSOAP, the eraser, and the professor, because I think they add, they're additive collectively to helping us understand what's going on with an individual kid. And here's the reality. Once you've scored the kid baseline, there's a way to automate this. It ain't that hard to go back and score them again at every 6 months intervals if we've created a system that's fairly fluid, you know, that takes somebody 10 or 15 minutes to do it at a go. And if you've used the instruments enough, you begin to really understand them inside and out. And it's not as cumbersome, because that's going to be one of the things that people are going to say. Well, I don't have time to do this. Well, look at all the time we're wasting trying to which ends up being at odds with each other in terms of, you know, trying to make something happen. I mean, I've said before, perhaps I'm naive, but I think we can get to the place where there's a way to do this that makes it more seamless for everybody.
You have virtual board members have questions, Blake and Judge Young. Both have their hand up.
Judge Young?
I had to turn my camera off. I was losing your audio a little bit, and I was hoping that was helping. But I just wanted to make sure that everybody knew that there's actually a juvenile rule on QRTPs. It's Rule 335, and it requires judges to evaluate a child's placement in QRTP, including whether or not they're getting the therapeutic services that they're supposed to be being provided at every hearing. And so that might be a good thing for the subcommittee to take a look at, too, is that's Juvenile Rule 335. That's all I had.
Thank you.
Melanie Opheim, that's awesome, Judge. I would only go back to our initial conversation of that. I don't know the percentage, but I think it's a very high percentage of kids in the QRTPs are not seeing judges. And so they've kind of just, they're not in that juvenile justice system. They're just in the dependency system.
No. I'm talking about dependency. It's in the dependency rules, Mel. So the kids who are just juvenile justice involved, those kids are not going into QRTP. The only kids that are going into QRT placements are the kids who are in DCS custody, because QRTP is a DCS placement. It's not in the behavioral health continuum of care. The kids who are not involved with DCS, those are the kids that we see in the BHIFs and the BHRFs and the therapeutic foster homes, because it's, you know, the QRTP is not available to kids who are just juvenile justice involved.
Right, right. That makes sense. I guess I'm just wondering if those kids are seeing anybody every 6 months, but yeah.
And they have to be.
Especially if they're not our kids, they're not doing treatment, so.
Yeah, per dependency rules, statute and rules, judicial officers have to be doing review hearings of every dependency case at least every 6 months. And I can tell you, we teach people to do that much more frequently. And so if you have a kid who is placed in QRTP, you're doing a review of that QRT placement at every subsequent hearing after the kid's placed.
And is that just up to the case manager, DCS case manager, kind of to make sure? I mean, or is it up to the judge? Is it up to the courts to kind of get them back in to see that?
Well, the judge is having the hearing, and so the judge is getting the information at every review hearing.
Maybe that's happening.
And then Blake.
Yeah, Blake Barney. So I'm hearing a lot of things that appear that the system is flawed. There's no such thing as perfection, so we know there's flaws in every system. However, as the board, I am curious what at least one DCS spokesperson has to say about what the board can do to help them, what they would like us to do to work in unison with them, and how we can be partners in helping with this whole process. Because there's obviously ideas that we have as board members, but I'm curious from the other side what DCS spokespeople would like to see from the board, or how they would like us to help them. So that's kind of my thoughts right now.
Thank you.
Well, I definitely like the idea of a universal risk assessment that, you know, everyone's being used, that everyone understands and can really articulate the risk rather than us just trying to, you know, say, well, this allegation or this charge or, you know, whatever that be. I think having something that we're, you know, a whole team from no matter what, where it's coming from, everyone can really utilize that risk analysis.
I appreciate the question. I think I want to kind of go back on something that Daniel was saying too that I think is really important, like the evaluation component and figuring out what a kid needs as far as treatment and placement and finding a placement that will take the hit are two very different issues. And I think both need to be addressed. And so, you know, we could get it perfect to where we are great on our evaluations. We know exactly what, you know, and then going out and finding, you know, approved or a qualified people that are working in these facilities or even a facility at all that will house this population, which I will work on getting an actual number for you. But, you know, those are two different issues. And so, you know, the resource, the definition of the problem and then actually addressing, you know, the problem, throwing resources at it, those are two things that I think need to be kept in mind. Because at the end of the day, no matter what data we have on this kid and recommendations we have, like, they have to live somewhere. And so, like, tonight, right? They have to be somewhere tonight. And I know when I started at DCS, that meant, you know, I might be having to sleep over with the kid in my office because he's got to sleep somewhere. And I think we've come a long way since then. And so I also want to point that out, that while there are still flaws, there has been progress in a lot of areas over the last 16 years or so that I've been here. But yeah, I think that's a very important thing to just also keep in mind, where, like, everything takes time. You know, evaluation takes time. You know, getting approval through insurance takes time. Getting approval from a judge takes time. And in the meantime, the kid's got to be somewhere. So. That's the reality that VCS pretty much faces, not just with this population.
I truly appreciate you saying that out loud. I'm going to comment on that if I can.
Sure.
I think that there one the problems that you just articulated are in part at least one in the same. And what I mean by that is if we have a structure that we're talking about in terms of, you know, using to kind of track progress or lack thereof, whichever the case may be. And we have an expectation that the people who are providing the care for the kids come along for the ride, and we create criteria and guidelines and structure that they must adhere to, that they must follow if they want to be in the game, so to speak. And then ways to evaluate whether or not they're doing what they need to do to train their staff and to support their staff to be able to do those things. That's what I mean when I say I think in part they're one of the same. They're one of the same thing. We have three different languages that we're speaking, and we're trying to forge some sort of agreement. Then it becomes who can yell the loudest more than it becomes. Are we having the same conversation? Do we really all want the same thing? I, that's just me from 30 years of experience working in the behavioral health field in the state of Arizona. And I think that, you know, there are no panaceas, and we're not going to create one out of this group, but we can certainly go a long ways in doing a lot better than we are currently, especially if we continue to remember that we're all on the same blood and team. You just have to try to come back to that when things get difficult.
I think the other thing too that I want to throw out there to keep in mind, just this budget. No one ever likes to talk about money, but budget is always an important thing. Like, you know, if DCS is having to pay for, you know, like if, I guess if qualification level, you know, rises, then that will bring with it probably higher contracts in order for to pay for it. And DCS's budget doesn't tend to go up. And so that's just another, like, housing to pay for it. I think it's always keep in mind as well.
All true, but should not prohibit us from trying to build it as we should. Does anyone have any other questions for the folks? DCS before we move on to the next item on the agenda with the remaining time that we have.
I don't want to keep beating it, but my issue is not an assessment. My issue is not an evaluation. I'm still talking about team processes, therapists, qualified therapists working with kids for a year, year and a half, recommendations, which I feel are clinical. They don't have to be a whole assessment to know a kid's doing great. And then recommendations of placement. And I still, maybe you guys can't answer it right now, but I don't know why that's not always heard. Or what happens after a placement is recommended and then it gets shut down and not really an explanation. I don't know. Maybe you talk to somebody else. It's just super frustrating.
You're having a continuum of care.
That was my own kids as well as other kids.
I had a program.
That has nothing to do with evaluation. These are kids that are doing well or aren't doing well, but my place has been recommended by a CFT and a family team and everybody involved. And then there is somebody who trumps it basically and negates it and says, no, they're going to go to a different home.
Yeah.
So I wish I didn't bring it up, but it happened 2 days ago. So it's fresh, but it's happened again over 20 times. So it's, I don't know if I'm doing something wrong. I don't know the difference between the two, QRTP versus my house. But I can't really get straight answers. And when somebody's in a CFT saying, like, well, what's the difference? Why can't they go to the freeway house? This is congregate care. There's not a lot of answers besides that's not where they're going. So yeah. The probation gets frustrated with it. Yeah. The therapists get frustrated that are working with the kids. So I just want to point out that has nothing to do with an evaluation. Like we're not having to reassess anybody at that point. So sometimes, and I've had a kid that got court ordered. So we took him and then DCS says, we're not paying. We don't, the court order means nothing to us. Their words and then email. So then I get frustrated, like, what am I not supposed to take a kid that got court ordered? So then I even have justice system and DCS kind of going like, well, we didn't say he'd go there. So then I don't know what to do. I don't know who to take and who not to take. But it kind of falls in my lap a lot as far as like which system am I listening or guided by? And then I don't want to not get paid for 6 months, which is what's happened with the kid. So it's, I mean, we're just trying to do right by the kids.
So if we have custody of a child, and you're on a CFT and there's a bit of a struggle, you know, my
name. Okay.
And I can
usually it's preemie, you know what I mean? Like they're just calling me like, hey, do you have a bed? This kid would want them to go to U-turn. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, for sure. And then it
you
just kind of gets stopped.
Call medicine right away.
Okay.
And I can.
And I've been told by placement. Yeah. I mean, I got written up a couple weeks ago by a placement and I got a VPN saying we took a kid that we didn't. And I'm like, well, we really didn't. But the statement was U-turn does this often. They take kids without asking us. Or requesting from us. So the second that happened with a kid getting court ordered from someplace else, I immediately contacted placement, just the generic placement email saying, hey, this kid got court ordered. DCS showed up yesterday. We have a so I'll get you the mouth. I don't want to fight for a
recommendation.
I have a question. Who does make it? You all know who rides.
So when the referral party comes in, then it is gathering the information, placement administration. Then we also communicate and say, it says right here, Ms. Mel, that it will be in the child's best interest. Do you have a bed? Nope. We'll go somewhere else. But when it is during a CFT team meeting, then it would be on a team meeting. If a placement administrator is involved, then they're the ones listening. But sometimes the information doesn't make it the whole way. And we're going to work on a referral based on what we see.
I mean, in the case of the kid this week, it was 3 months worth of he's going to go to U-turn. The DCS case manager called me. She was excited. He's coming tomorrow. And then she called me back. I mean, she pretty much had cancellation emails like cancel, cancel, cancel. He can't come. They said no. And then she talked about the placement. So then I don't know who those people are. But the CFT was on board, the DCS workers was on board, DCS, the supervisor was on board, but someone in the placement team said no. So I don't know.
And we have two teams, emergency and non-emergency. So sometimes they can
How does that get decided which team that goes to?
The time frame. Any placement needed,
okay.
8:00 to 2:30, that's
okay.
Not emergency, something
okay.
Less.
I mean, if they're YDI, it's not an emergency, but I don't know, maybe it gets shuffled around, I don't know. Okay.
And sometimes, yeah, placement administration is a loop in. You'll have a supervisor kind of talk about when they're going to send the kid, because they have another kid there. They start talking to the placements.
Did we lose the primary meeting folks?
I think we did. I don't see them logged in anymore.
Okay.
I'm hoping they're going to log back in. It looked like they were having like some kind of issue because we were using sound and then the whole thing froze and then now they're gone. So.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it's Jenna or Ashleisha that's doing it, but my guess is that they're probably working on straightening it out right now. So
I emailed Jenna just to let her know that we were having issues.
Okay, cool.
I was just about to send a message, so I was going to ask if anybody did before I hit send. Thanks, Joke Jen. Appreciate it.
No problem.
This is Jenna Mitchell. Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you now.
Okay, we lost connectivity. I called in on my phone. We're taking a 5-minute break so I can do a reboot on the computer and reestablish connectivity. So okay. For subcommittee members and members of the public, we'll take a 5-minute break and then we'll resume.
And Jenna, it's Judge Young. I need to log off at 3:15. I've got court hearings. I've actually got Healthy Boundaries court this afternoon.
Okay, thank you, ma'am.
All right, so I'm turning the recording on.
We're back after some technical delays. So what I want to do now with the time that we have left, we're re-recording again. With the time we have left is maybe to start going through what people learned from their research regarding the issue of guiding principles so that we can make a decision about whether or not we want to write our own or whether we want to just adopt something that somebody else has already done. But until we kind of go through what we learned, it's hard to do that. So Peter, care to go first?
Sure. Yeah, we can start. Peter Morey. So I was assigned Washington, Tennessee, Rhode Island, and Pennsylvania. And I sent late to Major Mitchell to get it all sent out to you. Just kind of quickly to try to save the time. Tennessee doesn't really have much people, actually. Their sex offender, they're coming from the standard of sex offenders are highly manipulative and you can't trust them. So, program, basically. So, not a whole lot of rehabilitation.
Did you even find it, the sex offender management board?
There's nothing in Tennessee. Yeah. And so I'll just kind of skip to the best ones. That's probably what we want to consider Washington. They have a pretty detailed and thorough sex offender management board. Juveniles, core guiding principles, juveniles are fundamentally distinct population from adults. And their policies have to reflect the ongoing brain development, which is something we're considering. They recognize that most youth who offend do not detect and treated, and they also as a recognized harm. So intervention beyond the risk so will increase the level of their offending, which is also something we've discussed. Risk and protective factors need to be considered together, and obviously, least restrictive placement governs, and the treatment plan follows the youth from the institution through pool. It doesn't restart any transition points, so it's cumulative. I also put the low chart into that, that low that you can see when it gets to. Again, my fault on that. The problem with Washington, I think we're going to run into it, is their sex offender management board was put together with all of these in 2011. I'll volunteer what it's similar to what we have. It fell apart and scattered. So I think the lesson from this to learn is we need to think about things that are going to be lasting and have to think about, okay, how do we. Like today, we're discussing, and I kind of mentioned this to Scott in the break, we have, you know, three or four different languages being spoken just between the residential facilities. Mental health and law and medicine and law speak two different languages also. So how do we create something that's going to create those pathways that's going to last, that is going to keep the continuum going from accusation through assessment to whatever, if there's any sort of dependency or punitive system through rehabilitation. So kind of overwhelming. Sorry, this kind of process, everything I just heard, but
it was overwhelming from the time I saw what Colorado did since they've been working on it. It became overwhelming to me when I saw that.
So I think Washington's worth looking at. Pennsylvania is okay, probably the second best. Again, great principles, it falls apart on application. Tennessee is kind of what we want to avoid. And Rhode Island, the juvenile side is stronger than the adult side. Public safety, victim protection are the main guiding principles. Multidisciplinary team, they emphasize individualized treatment. Caregiver is an active participant, not just notified, so they involve the planning and progress. Victim really drives the reunification process, so they don't automatically get reintroduced. There's the victim voice in there. And providers, again, independently licensed, Medicaid certified, but standard qualifications where that I'm liking, where we have some sort of certification proposed by the board. In the state, they do actually have a sexting carve out where a juvenile treated sexting as a status offense, not delinquency adjudication, but no registration and really kept out of bonuses.
If I may, Scott Nagley, we have some ground to cover, discussions to have regarding the registration issue as it relates to juveniles. And I'm not sure that today obviously is not the place and the time to start to delve into that, but that's something that I want for us, you know, to come out of here where whenever that is, with some recommendations about that issue. Because the reality is the recidivism rates for kids that have successfully completed treatment as a group are really pretty low. And if the issue is risk, and that's what registration is all about, then it's inconsistent with what we know from recidivism data.
And one thing I want to point out with Rhode Island and Pennsylvania and Tennessee, with a difference from Washington, is all of them have their consensus federal management focused on the highest risk individuals. So they're not stratifying the risk. They're kind of like, okay, this is a bad kid, bad offender. Rhode Island is intentionally kept their population small so they can kind of have enough services. But I think because they have such a concentration on the high level offenders, their registration just kind of follows with that. That makes sense. But I think Washington State is probably more like what we're looking at, or would be worth considering to create this hybrid. I know Colorado. But I think also, like I said, it's worth keeping in mind if for some legislative reason, or how we're going to make these recommendations have some staying power.
Kentucky, Maryland, and Louisiana. Looking for this stuff is difficult right off the bat. It helps. A lot of these places they had some semblance of a board. They have been updated for a while. None of them had an overall theoretical philosophical statement about guiding. Kentucky and Louisiana had policies, and Kentucky's policy said something to the effect of treatment should be based on guiding principles that are consistent with an evidence-based framework that supports effective care, and then kind of lists the things that, you know, they should do, things like family therapy, comprehensive assessments. Maryland did the same kind of thing. It said their guiding principles
should be. And it was the comprehensive assessments, family focused care, multi-systemic therapy, collaborative management, and specialized training. And Louisiana, individual program planning for youth adjudicated for a sex offense shall include of its primary objectives, protection of the public, reduction of risk that demonstrate reduced behaviors relating to delinquent behavior and offending, and enhancement of youth growth and development. So they just kind of give up. It was very fitting comparable to the CYM. It's very impressive. Your day really prepared. Help us.
He was feeling like I'm believing.
Well, Scott Nagley, what I found when I started to do research for the states that I was charged with doing is that the original intel that I got in terms of doing a cursory search about how many states actually have sex offender management boards, it was 16 or 17 states. As I dug into this more, what I'm finding by virtue of making phone calls to people is there aren't even sex offender management boards in some of those 16 and 17 states. The state of Texas does not have a sex offender management board. Because I talked to a gentleman, it took me about 30 minutes of conversation with him to realize that really what he was the guy that was one of the people that's in charge with certain counties' registration process. But the registration process wasn't emanating out of any overarching sex offender management board. Because they don't have one. So it turned into a conversation where you can't garner any information that doesn't exist. And it also, I think, speaks to just how big, if we, the state of Arizona, are going to do this in a meaningful way, how big the task at hand is and how many different layers there are to it.
Peter Morey. Kind of the same thing with Washington State, so this was a 2011 construct that kind of got, okay, we've got it, we're not going to think about it too much anymore, and the board gets reconvened at the legislature's pleasure, so it's not really a standing thing.
Well, I mean, having said that, I know that myself, Dr. Blades, Chairwoman Golden, and the folks from DPS are going to have a gathering later this month to talk about the importance of us being clear about what are our mandates and making sure that we're demonstrating that we're engaging in a process that's answering some of those mandates. Answering some of those mandates is part of what's going to get us to last beyond 4 years. So the extent to which we address the task at hand obviously, it's going to influence whether or not we have viability down the road. So,
well, and Peter Morey, I think one of the things to impress with that is that this whole subject area, adult and juvenile, and policies, and frankly, society with it, is a dynamic construct. It's not something that's one and done. Two, if we can impress the dynamism on it, that there needs to be some maintenance.
Do you want to talk any more about Colorado?
Everybody kind of knows they're the cream of the crop. I do have a contact there. Joe Kilroy knows the guy as well. You know, he's helped us out in Arizona more than anybody else. And his feedback, and I know I've talked to Joe about it, that it's not been easy. It's been an up and down, and they're still around, but it's been a lot of kind of back and forths and conversations, which I suspect we're going to have as well. So yeah, probably sticking to the task at hand. Delaware was kind of a wash. Utah has a new board, 2023, mostly talking about registration, and so I need to delve into it a little more. One of the board members from the big board had told me they'd give me a contact. I didn't get that from Jenna. Maybe she didn't give it to Jenna, but I'll try to touch base with her again. But I'd like to look into theirs more. I thought Idaho kind of had something too. But maybe we just pick our three or four states, look and see what they got, how they overlap, what we want to get rid of, what we want to add to. But I don't want to make it too more complicated.
Yeah, no,
it sounds like we have found more dead ends than anything. I would just say that as you know, I don't agree with everything Colorado has done, but they always act. I mean, when they have the school, especially with juveniles, when they have school involved and advocates involved, probation's involved, and they're all sitting at a table talking about this kid, that's pretty impressive. I would love to get to a point that I wouldn't have to worry about DCFs. It would be kind of like we're all at the table and everybody's assigning, and there's not a lot of behind the door decisions making about kids.
So how about if I propose this in the interest of us kind of making a decision about what our guiding principles are? Let's not make a decision today. Let's take between now and our next meeting to familiarize ourselves individually a little bit more with what Colorado's are, a little bit more what Idaho's are, perhaps the Washington one, and come back and decide whether or not we want to meld them together in some sort of meaningful way, or we just adopt what Colorado's got as ours. I don't think we're going to be at a loss. The question.
I'll just add, I have previously distributed the Colorado's to you. I have them up on the board for you. I know the adult subcommittee has reviewed them, as have you, and made a decision to make a recommendation yesterday to the larger board. So I don't know if you all want to, you know, maybe entertain that thought of, you've had them, you've reviewed them. Do you want to, are you prepared to move forward with those?
Yeah, I'm proposing that we not make a final decision today, that we collectively take individual time to look more closely at these three or four states, and that we come back together the next time and we make a decision about whether we meld them in some fashion, if there's something from one of the other states that's additive to what Colorado did, then we do that, and then we make a decision before we adjourn that next meeting. I'm aware of the fact that we have folks from ADJC are going to come and give us a presentation next time. I confirmed that today. So we'll have the benefit of the same kind of process we did today at the outset of our meeting. We're still working on trying to get the folks from Maricopa County Juvenile Court to come and do the same thing. And I had a conversation with Chief Mo about that, and he was going to get back to me about that. So my recommendation is we table one last time the discussion about guiding principles until our next meeting.
And I was going to ask you, what final decision are they coming up with, or what were you kind of throwing out there to us to possibly make a decision on?
A couple of you are on that subcommittee, so maybe you would want to speak to that.
There's a few of us actually that are on that subcommittee that are also this group. In yesterday's similar meeting to this one, we did make a decision collectively to adopt the Colorado guidelines as the guidelines as it relates to the adult side of this.
They can be tweaked, but that's just like an initial, this is who we're going to call.
Yes, okay. As far as the adult side.
Okay.
Of
the
good morning. I think probably in the interest of going back to the big board, I agree with tabling. However, I think it probably would give us in the interest of moving on to identify three or four states today and say, okay, you want to take a serious look at these, we'll have a decision for you next time, so they don't hear, well, we're still looking around.
So I think we've done that. I think we have Colorado, we have Idaho, we have Utah, and we have Washington. And if we all agree to just take, you know, some time between now and our next subcommittee meeting to look at those closely and make a decision about if they're, I mean, I think from my perspective, the point of departure is what Colorado has written. If there are things that are in these other, we'll call them guiding principles, I know that everybody's using that language, but that's missing in the Colorado stuff, then we can have a discussion about adding them to the Colorado stuff. But I don't think that they've done it and they did it well.
Sure. I just wanted
to. The real issue is, are we missing something? Yes.
And I just add for the record that Judge Young did have to log off for court. And Blake Barney has his hand up.
Hello, Blake.
Hey, guys. Blake Barney. So I mean, I tried to, full disclosure, I used ChatGPT to help me organize all of this information that I that's on the background materials, but I haven't done enough research into Utah, but I do know when it comes to Illinois, they've done a pretty good job. They've been around for quite some time. I think 28 years, it's like 97, 98, something like that, that they developed their board. So shortly after Colorado, and they've got like it says on the handout here, the best for juvenile specific rehab and family integration. So again, I'm not saying we shouldn't use Utah, but between Idaho, Hawaii, and Illinois has the best for the rehab specific for juveniles. So we may consider that one. And Idaho is great. It's very clinical. It's very structured. So if we want to go that route, we can certainly have Idaho included. And then the other aspect of all of this is Hawaii is a sex offender management team. They refer to them as boards, but they're not technically. They are sex offender management teams, so they call them SMTs. So I think we eliminate Hawaii from this, but there's certain things in the handout that we could take from it. And when it comes to coming up with our guiding principles, we can certainly adopt another state's principles, or we could look at it as here's kind of a grab bag of all of these different things that seem to work really well in these states. Let's figure out what's going to work the best in Arizona. And we as the experts should know likely what is going to be the most beneficial for juveniles in the state of Arizona that may not be the same as Idaho or Illinois or Utah or Washington or any other state, because Arizona has its specific aspects that juveniles are going to experience here that they might not in Utah or Idaho or Illinois or any of those places. So, my two cents on it is I'm happy to keep doing the research and looking into them, but let's not exclude Illinois yet, because I think that they do have a good rehab model for juveniles specifically.
So can Blake, hey, it's Scott Nagley. Can I ask you and Peter to do a couple things? And it sounds like Peter may have already done it, but is to make sure that we get those to Jenna so that she can put them up so that we all have easy access to them, so that we don't have to go look again ourselves to find what you've already discovered. So if we can do that, here in the next day or two, if it hasn't already been done, because I'll readily admit that I need to get in the practice of looking at what's already been put up on the website for us to have access to. I'm very much still getting used to the ritual here, and I've not been as good as I should have been at looking what's already been put up there. But if we can get it there, it'll make it easier for all of us to be able to do what I'm asking everybody to do between now and the next meeting.
Peter Morey, quick question. I agree with what Blake's saying. I mean, Washington's good on paper, but again, their system kind of fell apart. If Illinois has a more dynamic system, that might be worth looking at. The question I have, though, is Blake's talking about the rehabilitation and we're talking about the core guiding principles. And I sort of feel like we're getting a little beyond. We're making it a little bit more difficult on ourselves than we need to at this point. So are we looking just at the guiding principles kind of like?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and the answer to that.
Yeah. Because I agree with the rehabilitation. Is that something necessary?
But I took what you said to mean that the way they've written their guiding principles is in and around the use of a rehabilitation model. Am I missing what you said?
No, that's accurate. It's written off of a family integration and rehabilitation model, so that that's basically their main focus when it comes to juveniles and the Sex Offender Management Board is family reintegration, if possible, and the rehabilitation of juveniles within the sex offender treatment realm. So that's why I was, you know, considering them. And my information is on the handout from page like 183 to 192. So it's the very last stuff that's on there. And it's all broken down because, again, I use ChatGPT to help me organize it. So it's all broke down and tells you the differences and the similarities between each state. So if you get a chance to look at that, hopefully that helps clarify as well.
Yes. So you've already done it, is what you're saying. You've already passed it along to staff.
Yeah. Correct. And Maury, again, Blake, I'll join your confession. I used Quad. So.
So it sounds like we know what we're going to do with the guiding principles by the time we finish the next meeting, and we have a plan to report back to the larger board with respect to that. In the absence of having more time, I don't know that it makes any sense to try to bite off the last item that's on the agenda for today's meeting. So with everybody's agreement, I say we leave that for the next time as well.
I want to recommend it to the county attorney, possibly the office, come and talk about how a kid makes it information or not information or some other different diversion or
makes sense to me, given we're asking everybody else.
This is preferred because it would have been nice to have some of the people be able to. So if county attorney Maricopa, I mean, I don't know if Phil's still on there, is he involved with Maricopa coming, but the probation specifically, as well as the county attorney's office, might be a
well, as I said, we're still waiting to hear back from CJCC, so I haven't heard anything since I had a meeting with the chief.
Chief is on the phone. He's been on the call today.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So I'm going to trust that he'll get back to me and let me know.
Yeah, I'm just thinking it would be a good, robust conversation if the county attorney's with CJCC.
Exactly. Yeah, Maury, I know also the juvenile defense team, juvenile defense body has some serious concerns about the use of polygraphs, so that's important.
And just to be clear, item B on to today's agenda, which we're going to carry over to next time, is a piece of that. And I'm told, though, because I readily confessed a second ago that I've not been as good at looking at what's been posted on the website, all of the documents related to item D on the agenda are, in fact, available to everybody to access and see. Some of them are fairly long. Some of them are less so. But they're all relevant to the work with juveniles and the discussion about polygraph.
And Blake Barney again. Hey guys, I think it's also important that we have Judge Young available for that, as she's, you know, the juvenile court justice representing the board and with our subcommittee now. So I think that it would be a really good thing for her to be present for that conversation as well.
So it sounds like we're in agreement that we move that last item to next meeting's agenda. And are there any other things regarding the things we've been speaking about today that we need to tidy up before we offer an adjournment for today?
No, Neil, I would just ask if there's anything else you guys wanted to know about GCSF. I mean, I'm obviously in the thick of things with the system itself, but I didn't know if you guys thought it went or didn't go, or just you got the information you wanted, or just kind of.
I mean, getting the information with respect to the scope of the problem. And where do our kids in Arizona sit in the system, and where are they in terms of numbers of them, and how many of them are not educated, and those kinds of things will be helpful to me in trying to play a part.
I think Nick is about. On our board, so we can kind of
see. He's on it. I believe he's on it. So with that in mind, can I get a motion to adjourn today's meeting?
Motion to adjourn.
Exactly. Adjourn.
All in favor?
Oh, all in favor.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion adjourned.
Thank you. See you next time, Blake.
The wavelength or
smart turn is my button.
Yes, I will be there in person next month. Sorry guys, I've got a meeting back immediately after this. So I'll see you there next week or next month for sure.
Right. See you
Monday, Blake. See you guys.